this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
This is the only resource left in this community for Black and Brown students. I mean, this is it. This is the only resource. This is the space for this community to come together. And you take that away, what's left?
Oakland parents and students are occupying Parker Elementary School to stop the closure and privatization of schools in the Black and Brown community.
So unfortunate that it's tainted by having somebody like Elon Musk in charge who goes on Twitter tears, insulting entire groups of people, and doesn't take it seriously when there's racism in his plant, and likes to pretend that he's taking it seriously, but then still lets the conditions fester.
Lisa Dan, a former Tesla worker, spoke out at Twitter about the real conditions under Elon Musk.
I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our babies can go to school and be safe. I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our children in every one of their communities is safe from gun violence.
Could more lives have been saved in Uvalde? Parents want accountability as to why repeated calls for help were not answered by Texas officials. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. In Houston, Texas, the American Federation of Teachers, National President Randy Weingarten, National Education Association President Becky Pringle, Ovidia Molina, President of the Texas State Teachers Association, Texas Congressional Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, and other leaders and organizers held a rally to stand up against gun violence, responding to the tragedy in Uvalde and Buffalo, New York, as well as the NRA convention that was held in Houston over the weekend.
I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our babies can go to school and be safe. I will not stop lifting my voice until every one of our children in every one of their communities is safe from gun violence. The 3 million members of the NEA will not stop lifting their voice until every single one of our children has what they need and deserve, and they can live and thrive and be brilliant. What are you prepared to do? I didn't hear you. What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared to do? I know you will not stop until we end gun violence in our schools, in our neighborhoods, and communities. Texas, what are you prepared to do? I have with me the president of the Texas State Teachers Association.
Yeah! Yeah! We are all hurting. We don't want one more. But every single time this happens, it's ridiculous that I have to say every single time this happens, I get thoughts, I get prayers, and then I get excuses when it comes to action. We are not going to take it anymore. Make sure you stay mad. Make sure you remember. Make sure the lives of those children, the lives of those educators, those families that are shattered, to stay with you, because they can't forget. And every time we hear it, educators, from teachers, homeowners, custodians, bus drivers, we think it could have been us? When will it be me? How many can I save? That is not the way our schools should be in America. Texas loves to be number one. Let's make our students safe and be number one.
What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared to do? What are you prepared to do? On board!
You just heard from Becky Pringle and Ovidia Monina, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee.
I could come to you as many things. I could come to you as a mother. I can come to you as a living witness, as a member of the United States Congress. I always come with papers. These are papers and papers and papers of mass murders in America. 400 million guns, 45% of all the guns in the world are in the United States. And so here's what I want you to get. First of all, I want you to look at these babies, and I want you to be reminded of those in Uvalde, and I must stop and say to give prayers to holes in the hearts of these families that will never be repaired. I watched the video as they screamed, I'm on my way to Uvalde. I watched them as they screamed, let me go in to save my children. Any one of you could not imagine that kind of pain and that kind of disaster in your life. I want you to look at these babies and know that they love teddy bears, they love Legos, they love hugs, they love good food, but you know what they've got now? Body bags. I refuse to allow my children to know about body bags. And I hope you will as well. You know what else they know? The Vietnam terminology of killing fields. And they must not know about killing fields. I stand on their life, not on their death. And so what I'm asking for the NRA to do is to cancel itself. Cancel yourself right now. Walk out of the building that is paid for by taxpayer dollars. Cancel yourself today. Cancel yourself tomorrow. Cancel yourself on Sunday. Walk out.
That was Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott and other state officials have been criticized for their response to the tragic event in Uvalde. Abbott initially praised law enforcement for their quick response to the shooting. New information revealed that 19 officers were on the scene while waiting for an hour for a tactical unit to enter the building. Abbott said at a recent press conference that he had been, quote, misled about the police response and expects a full investigation. A week prior to the Uvalde shooting, an online ad for Daniel Defense, the company that sold the guns to 18-year-old Salvador Ramos, ran an ad that showed a young boy holding an AR-15-like rifle on his lap, along with the caption, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Also on Sunday, Anthony Cooley, DOJ spokesman, stated the Justice Department will conduct a review of the police response to the shooting to provide an independent account of law enforcement actions and responses that day and to identify lessons learned and best practices to help first responders prepare for and respond to active shooter events. According to the department, Uvalde's Mayor Don McLaughlin requested the inquiry. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden paid their respects to the grieving families. NBC reports before leaving the church, Biden walked over to demonstrators gathered nearby, and as they chanted, "Do something," he responded by mouthing the words, "We will."
Hay que llamar las cosas como son. ¿Qué son? ¿Qué es? The truth is asesino. John Cornyn is
asesino.
NRAs es
asesino.
Son asesinos. 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 Asesinos.
In 1984, renowned Mexican singer and songwriter Juan Gabriel wrote a ballad that would become the most played song at memorials and funerals in his home country. It's called Amor Eterno, or Love Eternal.
Tú eres la
tristeza y de mis ojos y lloran en silencio por tu amor. Me miro en el espejo y veo en mi rostro el tiempo que he sufrido por tu adiós. Prefiero estar dormido que despierto de tanto y tanto que me duele que no estés. Como quisiera que tú vivieras, que tus ojitos jamás se hubieran cerrado. Voy a estar contigo para seguir amándolo.
Juan Gabriel, Amor Eterno. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. In early June, the AFL-CIO will be holding a national convention in Philadelphia. There is a growing tide of workers organizing from Amazon to Starbucks. David Van Dusen, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, has presented a resolution to prepare for a general strike if there is another attempted coup or insurrection. He talks as well about the rise of racist attacks and fascism. He and his council have also submitted a resolution for the right of the rank and file to vote for the leadership of the largest trade union federation in the country. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed David about these issues.
So, David, why don't we talk about these two resolutions that your council has have put in, how they came about, and why you think there has to be a fight in the AFL-CIO?
Well, look, the two resolutions that our executive board passed, which were forwarded to the national AFL-CIO, one was preemptively getting the national organization on board to call for a general strike if there's another crisis in democracy post our next presidential election in 2024. There was not a workable means or plan to push back, in my opinion, in 2020 when we face a crisis. And just because that attempt at a neo-fascist coup was not successful does not mean that another attempt is not A, likely, and B, would be more of a threat in the future. So we want to be prepared. Our strongest weapon as a working class is the general strike, because it's our labor that gives us power. If we withhold that labor, the capitalist economy stops dead in its tracks. So for us to contemplate what a true crisis, existential crisis in democracy would mean, we have to contemplate what it would take to effectively push back on that. Of course, there'll be many means, mass demonstrations, the works, but the general strike has to be one of the tools in the tool belts. So instead of trying to engage in a last minute campaign or struggle or one labor council seeking to go one way or another going another, we want to have that coordinated discussion now so we're prepared in 2024. So that's the resolution number one. Resolution number two is basically saying we have to walk the talk, right? If we're going to talk about defending democracy, if we're going to talk about what it means to build more democracy in this country, we also have to be honest and reflective and say, well, what can we do to make the labor movement itself more democratic? So that second resolution, among other things, calls for a direct election of officers. Where right now, there's weighted voting in internationals have means to make major decisions of who the next officers and president of the National AFL-CIO will be. We want to go the same direction UAW recently went, where every single member, millions of members, would get to cast a ballot and choose on their own what direction they want to take the organization, who's going to be president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, et cetera. This to us is common sense as Americans. We would not settle for a system where the people did not directly elect the president of the United States, right? And we should be ready to defend our right to elect who the next president of the United States is. But at the same time, we now need to move our organization into the 21st century and give our members a direct vote on who is in charge at the top. Also, we believe, and it's in that second resolution, that state labor councils and local labor bodies should have more autonomy to express political opinions without being hamstrung by internal rules, which would cede power to the national AFL-CIO in discussing various political matters. So these are the directions we want to go as the Vermont State Labor Council, and we want to bring the discussion to the national AFL-CIO. And of course, these are part and parcel of our United 10-point program here in Vermont, which is our progressive platform for building true union power, not just here, but we believe it applies also to the struggle in the rest of the United States.
You've organized some chartered motorcycle club. What do you think that should be a mass mobilization? It seems like there are no mass mobilizations of workers to protest this rise of fascist terror and massacres. They continue, they go on and on, and there's no mass mobilization saying enough is enough of all working people.
Well, we did charter a motorcycle club, which we're actively organizing here in Vermont, that would be an auxiliary to our elected sergeant at arms for the State Labor Council. And we see that as one means to be prepared for threats if they are to come up. But let's get back to our roots here. If we're going to fight fascism effectively, we have to look back into the 1990s, where there was very effective struggles in combating fascism on the community level. When anti-racist action was most active across this country, there were 60 chapters across the entire United States and in parts of Canada that militantly and physically chased fascists out of whole cities, whole towns, right, and ended fascist organizing. And then the means that they did it was direct confrontation, and it worked. Because one of the things that fascists value above all else is the belief in their own physical power, right? And when you take that away from them, it takes the wind out of their sails, and they become much harder to recruit new angry folks into their ranks, right? So one of the ways we defeat fascism is direct confrontation. And I do hope to see a resurgence of groups like ARA rise again across this country. But that's not the only way we defeat fascism, Steve. We also have to do it by providing a real progressive left-wing alternative to the politics of the Democrats and Republicans. Now, why do people turn to the extreme right? Because they are so disenfranchised and so disillusioned with the failures of the Democratic Party and liberal politics that they're looking for an alternative. So what organized labor must do is create a true left-wing pole, a working class left, which is different from the Democrats, different from the liberals, and seeks to win real social, political, and economic gains through mass action, workplace organizing, and union organizing across the country. And when we do that and could show that we could create a true alternative and build real power, then that's way disenfranchised folks, people that are at the end of the rope, they will turn to that as a movement as they did in the 30s, right, with the further left organizing. But if we just pitch our wagon to the Democratic Party and all the failures that entails, then we're going to create a breeding ground for more and more fascist organizing in the U.S. Okay. I know that we have begun to reach out to other labor federations, councils, to talk about what we're doing here and why we would like them to support them. Whether or not they end up on a floor and have a true debate, we will see. I like to think that we have a new administration post Richard Trumka in the national AFL-CIO, and I hope to see them support open and honest debate about defending democracy and about building true democracy within the labor movement itself.
That was David Van Dusen, president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, discussing the fight for a general strike against a possible coup and the need for a democratic trade union movement for the upcoming AFL-CIO convention. 1, 2, 3.
I'm a living sunset, lightning in my bones. It pushed me to the edge, but my will is stone. Cause I believe in a better way. Fools will be fools and wise will be wise, but I will look this world straight in the eyes.
Better Way by Ben Harper. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Lisa Dan was a software programmer at Elon Musk Tesla in Fremont. She recently spoke out against Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter because of his racist and union-busting tactics at Tesla.
I'm a former worker at Tesla, and I worked there for about 5.5 years as a software engineer. I joined Tesla because I care very passionately about solving climate change, and I saw the difference that the company was making, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I still see that difference, and I'm still grateful for that. And it's just so unfortunate that it's tainted by having somebody like Elon Musk in charge, who goes on Twitter tears, insulting entire groups of people, and doesn't take it seriously when there's racism in his plant, and likes to pretend that he's taking it seriously, but then still lets the conditions fester. So I eventually left because I was just so frustrated at Elon. And I'm just going to tell a couple of things that I witnessed personally related to his union busting activities. I first found out about the major union effort when there was a company-wide email that was denouncing a blog post that was made by a pro-union person. So they were basically trying to undermine the testimony of somebody who was in favor of a union. And not long after that, they started, you could tell that the union was gaining power because they were pushing so hard against it. And they, you would go to the bathroom, and when you're sitting on the toilet, you see on the wall of the door that closes the stall, a flyer that talked about why you should not sign a union card. And it was a bunch of baloney. I mean, this was years ago, but I remember specifically them claiming that signing a union card is like giving your address to a stranger, because you have to put the address on your union card, I guess. And they also mentioned, you know, they were really emphasizing the fee, you know, the cost of the union dues, even though, of course, you know, if you know much about unions, the idea is that the contract that you negotiate more than compensates for the dues that you're paying. So it was clearly just, you know, disinformation, the company not wanting to lose power. So there was that. There were those. And then it was widely reported that during their big layoff several years ago, that they were really targeting people who had been working on the union organizing efforts. And there were some very clear-cut cases. I'm not going to go into detail because the people involved can tell that better than I can. But what I will say is that I witnessed the chilling effect that it had on the unionizing effort. Like, it really, they were very successful at stamping out people's will to continue, which I think is very frustrating. I talked to people, you know, just in the cafeteria after that. I remember asking somebody who had joined, I guess after that incident, after the layoff incident, and asking what he thought of unionizing. And he basically said, I'm not gonna touch that. I don't wanna lose my job. I don't even wanna have this conversation. And so unfortunately, the illegal union busting tactics worked. And it takes so long to prove the illegality, even though there's finally been, you know, some supposed accountability. In the meantime, they successfully stamped out the spark. And So that's, you know, I just wanted to share that with anybody who wonders what it's like to work at a company where Elon's in charge. That's part of it. I mean, everybody everywhere was a little bit confused about what was going on at the very beginning. But there were already clear class lines being drawn within the company. Like, before masks were available to everybody, so this was way back at the beginning when we didn't even have the amount of PPE, the masks were only available to the workers in the office, which, on the one hand, I guess we know now that probably workers in that enclosed space were more vulnerable, but it definitely seemed like a class issue at the time that they were basically giving the masks to the white-collar workers only.
Right.
And then, of course, as we all know...
his public comments.
Yeah, that's true. He claimed that he thought that they that COVID would not infect more than a tenth of the U.S. population. No, not a tenth, sorry. A tenth of a percent of the U.S. population, which that would be, 300,000? So, you know, more than that Americans have died from COVID, so let alone being infected. So he was just wildly off with his predictions, and it really felt like sort of a profit-motivated desire to downplay it. But he still has a lot of people who just support him anyway. He made people keep working even when it wasn't safe, in violation of the health orders, which were then lifted a week later. And it was really hard to get information. Like, they kept sending these kind of propaganda emails to the company about, like, oh, we haven't had any infections and we haven't had any transmissions. But at that time, testing was widely unavailable. So how did we know? We had no idea. And, you know, if somebody did get infected, you could claim that they weren't infected at work. So it was a mess.
That was Lisa Dan, a former software programmer at Tesla in Fremont, who spoke in opposition to the takeover of Twitter by billionaire Elon Musk. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. There is an epidemic of the closure of public schools in the Black and Brown communities. In Northern California, parents, children, and community supporters occupied Parker Elementary School in East Oakland, which the school board had ordered closed. At the same time, they have expanded and opened charters run by billionaires. There was a community labor solidarity event on Saturday, May 28, 2022.
What we're doing right now is healing the community. OUSD is selling the front of that they're full-service community schools, which they're not. This is how you start. This is what transparency looks like. We want them to look at us as a mock of what they should be demonstrating to us. We want them to know that we're here to serve the community. And when you say that you want every student to thrive, you don't leave people behind. We're going to offer classes starting on Tuesday because Monday is a holiday. But Tuesday to Thursday, we will be active in this building. We will be teaching 21st century literacy because we know that our kids need to excel and they need to be able to support their families to come. We need to start owning things. So when we say we're reclaiming this land and we're giving it back to the community, we're giving it back because your tax dollars pay into this school. We need that to work for the community that it serves. They just got billions of dollars for community schools from the governor that's coming down the line, and they're giving that to schools that they plan to close next year.
My name is Timothy Killings. I'm a case manager at Westlake Middle School, and I'm here because they're closing down schools in Black and Brown neighborhoods, and we want the community to have the school. So we asked them, we went on strike, we packed their board meetings. We've tried everything to try to get them to reverse their decision. So I feel like this is the most militant action we've done took so far, and I'm here for it. You know?
And
there's a lot of money in California. You have a lot of billionaires.
A lot of money in Oakland. They just got $66 million for community schools. Some of the schools that they put in for that grant are the exact same schools that they're closing down. So we know that the money's there. It's just the will is not. And so whenever politicians and rich people are going against the will of the people, that's that you get stuff like this. you know, liberations and land liberation. So I feel like this is the direction for it.
And they're not closing any schools in the white community. It's all black. You think that has something to do with systemic racism?
Or? I definitely think that is institutionalized racism. I think that it's an intensification of gentrification. And, yeah, we know it's racism, and that's why we're fighting back. And like I said, this school was 58% black. This school was almost 60% black, 30% Latino, and almost every school that you look at, you can look at this poster right here, it's going on around the whole country, where it's attacks on our communities, but we're here for the fight.
My name is Frankie Velez, and I'm here today to support the community, support the justice community, to help to emancipate and liberate ourselves as human beings, as people who are searching for our own path, and to no longer be oppressed. I mean, that's why I'm here, and I have two babies. I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. Yeah, for my children.
My name is Jaceana, and I'm 13. And I came here today for Parker just to help out and, like, support. Well, we've been here for, like, a week already. We've been sleeping here, and we're just trying to have people come out and support us. So, yeah.
And closing a school, what would that mean to you and the community here?
Well, for the community and for me too, like, this school has been here for a long time. And, like, especially for the community around here, like, it's going to be hard for the kids to go to school because this is, like, the one school that everybody walks here and comes here. So my sister, her name is Jemiah. She's been here for 5 months, and she loves this school. So it's, like, it's closing and it's sad. They say that there's not enough kids here, and there's supposed to be 300. And there's only 200 something, but I feel like, why does it matter? Like, it doesn't matter. There's a school, and there's kids here, and you're teaching them.
My name's Love, and I think it's not fair. I think it's not fair because they're moving, like, other kids to another school that might be far away from their home, and they're gonna have to, like, walk and waste more gas.
Kimberly King, I'm a psychology faculty at Laney College, and I'm here with I represent the Laney Poor People's Campaign. And I'm here because all students deserve community schools. There's no reason for them to be shutting down these schools. Oakland is a very wealthy city. They need to, if they can't afford it, they need to find a way to tax corporations more. It's ridiculous. All kids deserve a school in their neighborhoods. They shouldn't have to go far away to find school. Why is it okay for rich kids to have private schools with small numbers of kids in the class? But when a poor school has less than 25 kids in the class, oh, that's too small. That doesn't make any sense. If anything, the poor kids need smaller schools more. Laney is cutting so many of its classes, and not just Laney, but all the Peralta colleges. The union and the students and the faculty are trying to fight against that, but the chancellor just thinks for some reason that we should be cutting classes, even though it's been a pandemic. Of course enrollment has gone down. That doesn't mean if we keep cutting classes, that's going to guarantee that we'll have low enrollment, which is going to guarantee that we're going to keep having low enrollment. If students can't get the classes they need to pass, then in order to get their degree, they're going to start going to other districts. And as you know, City College of San Francisco they laid off 38 tenured faculty. I've never heard of that happening. Tenured faculty in addition to 130 plus part-time faculty.
My name is Shane. I am a teacher in Oakland Unified School District. I teach at a high school.
What's going on here and with the teachers, and are they fighting to stop these closures?
Yeah, there are teachers, parents, students, other community members all, you know, kind of joining together in this effort to stop the school closures of not just Parker, but also the other three that they're trying to close at the end of this year, or they have closed essentially, and then also the 8 or 9, however many they're trying to close next year as well. The main goal, you know, in this state of the Democrats, you know, seems to be to, you know, try as best as possible to make sure that the labor movement is divided up. So the building trades, you know, who hold a lot of, you know, have a lot of workers and have a lot of sway in the Alameda Labor Council. So there you saw why I think that, you know, they've been for this ballpark to be going. But John Fisher, who's the owner of the A's, also heavily involved in the privatization of public schools through a charter network called Knowledge is Power program, Kippin' Rocket Ship. So that's, you know, where the Longshore, the, you know, the coalition with Longshore made sense is they're fighting this privatization of their Howard Terminal. And as teachers are fighting the privatization of their sites.
My name is Joel Velasquez. I am a parent of three, Oakland resident 30 years, and I live here in District 6, a few blocks away from Parker Elementary. 2012, there was a very similar situation where the school board said there was a budget deficit. And after a long year of trying to engage with the school board, the superintendent, even city council, they still decided to close five schools, which were the first of 30 schools in total. That's what OUSD wanted to do. And on the last day of the school, just like Aslina, we decided we're not leaving. And we took over the space and started a Freedom School there on the last day of school, almost exactly 10 years ago. We created programs of Freedom School for kids during the summer there, Monday through Friday. We held events on the weekends to kind of talk about public education and what's happening with charters moving in. Today, I think we're at 41 charters in Oakland, California. We have the highest number of charter schools per capita for the size of the district than any other city in the state of California. I think there's a much larger conversation just to bring the national. This is something that's happening in every city across the nation right now and has been happening throughout the nation around attacks in black and brown communities around closing schools and moving charters in. So it's not just Oakland. There's definitely multiple layers. I mean, look around where the space is at, right? I mean, I got a view of the entire Bay Area. We have houses up here that are $1 million houses. There are people that don't want to see an almost all black school in the neighborhood, right? I mean, that's facts. But we can't be making decisions around real estate or those kind of things when we were talking about our public education system, that this is the only resource left in this community for black and brown students. I mean, this is it. This is the only resource. This is the space for this community to come together. And you take that away, what's left?
Those were the voices of students, teachers, and community supporters of the occupation to keep Parker Elementary School open in Oakland, California.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take.
Gil Scott Heron, Save the Children. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. This Memorial Day weekend, as many people are traveling on planes, over 5,000 flights have been canceled, not only due to weather, but COVID cases among flight attendants. A federal court judge appointed by former President Trump has issued an order that the government cannot order passengers to wear masks. Judith Anderson, who is an industrial hygienist with the Association of Flight Attendants, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the manipulation of studies by Boeing and the airline industry to claim that their planes are safe and passengers have little risk of getting COVID in flight, despite the continuing dangers of COVID-19.
Initially, in sort of February, March of 2020, when the world seemed to shut down, the federal government, you know, was President Trump was in the office with White House, and he was not in favor of introducing any legislation, not in favor of any executive order or, you know, promoting any requirements. So the federal government early on took a very hands-off approach to the pandemic, as people will remember. And so the airlines really had to step in and try to figure out a plan to reassure the flying public to come back. I mean, initially, the passenger loads dropped as much as 96%. I think that was April 2020. Thousands and thousands of aircraft were parked in the desert because they weren't being used. I think it was 64% of the world's fleet was parked. And so after 6 months or so, it became clear that this pandemic was sticking around, wasn't going to disappear. The airlines had significant financial troubles, and they wanted to get people back. And, you know, there were no mask mandate other than airline policies. There were no vaccinations. It's impossible to socially distance on an aircraft. Good luck with that. The federal government, after about 6 months in, July 2020, came out with a report to say, don't worry about it. It was the Department of Health and Human Services, the Center for Disease Control and Transportation Security Administration, the FAA was in there as well. And it was this report that talked about the importance of social distancing, the need to wear a mask, the need to sanitize surfaces. But the report didn't use the word shall once. There were no requirements. It was all, well, they should do this and they should do that. So, they claimed that the pandemic was now over, that travelers could come back, that aircraft are safest environment you could be in other than a hospital. And which is also amusing because everybody's avoiding hospitals because nobody wants to get COVID, right? So, there was just a failure, in my opinion, of leadership to provide the necessary protections for flight attendants in particular, but also pilots and passengers.
And the stress on your membership must have been tremendous, that they were being told to go back to work. Really, you're on your own, it sounds like, without proper protection, even masks. I mean, it sounds bizarre.
Absolutely. It was a very strange and very stressful time. And you can appreciate, especially if you're someone who has small children at home, or if your spouse is immunocompromised, or if you're taking care of elderly parents. I mean, we would have reports from our flight attendant members who would suspect exposure to somebody on board, somebody who was coughing and sneezing and had all of the symptoms of COVID. And then they would have to pay their own hotel bill to stay over for a few days before they would go home, because they couldn't have that on their conscience to go home potentially with COVID themselves and infect their family. If you're a regional flight attendant, you're not making a lot of money in the first place. So to put that on top of people and expose them to, you know, without necessary appropriate protections, it was very stressful. And then the rules changed, and they were allowed to quarantine, and there were 14 days, and then the 14 was reduced to 10, and the 10 has now been reduced to 5 or 0, depending. In fairness, now vaccines are widely available, and the airlines promote the vaccines to their credit, and they certainly have a higher rate of vaccination in their work groups than, you know, the general population, but particularly in the first year, there were no protections in place. Yeah, well, I know of at least two that have died. It's difficult to know in some cases, did they get COVID at work or did they get COVID somewhere else? But certainly two certainly died related to work exposure. Many people have got sick. I don't believe that there is a case count of illness because the airlines don't consistently share that information with our local unions. So, at some airlines, they may share a monthly list, and at others, they refuse to. They cite HIPAA concerns, I think. But the science was clear that COVID was largely spread by the airborne route. And that involves either droplets, big particles that fall out of the air quickly because they're bigger, so they fall out of the air by gravity, and they're when somebody coughs or sneezes. And then there are the aerosols, which are the smaller, teeny tiny particles that I'm exhaling as I talk. And they are smaller and stay suspended in the air for longer and travel farther and stick around. And on aircraft, because the relative humidity is low, the air is dry. Anyone who's flown knows that. The issue is that the particles that people exhale, whether they're visible or not, desiccate, they dry out, and they break into smaller particles. Or they can, and they stay suspended longer, and they also travel farther in the air. So the low humidity on aircraft is another reason, in addition to people are packed in, and people don't consistently wear their masks, and there are lots of factors. But that dry air also contributes to onboard risk of disease transmission.
And there were a number of studies done, financed by Boeing, financed by the airline industry, which have suggested or said that basically airlines are even safer than any other place to be.
Sure, yeah. No conflict of interest there. Absolutely objective source. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Boeing came out and said, being on an aircraft sitting next to someone is like being 6 feet away from them. Airbus came out and said 7 feet, might have been the other way around, but you get the idea. It's ridiculous. The United Airlines CEO was quoted in the media this week as saying that you can be, as a direct quote, "That's why being on an airplane next to two people in a middle seat is the equivalent of being 15 feet away from someone in a building." Wow. I don't know where he came up with 15 feet. It's just saying words, you know. The airlines, of course, are motivated to get people back. And the aircraft manufacturers do not want to be blamed for this. And certainly, I mean, the design of the system is such that the ventilation air comes in the top of the sidewall and is exhausted at the floor. And that's how it's supposed to work. Not too much back and forth flow, but there is back and forth flow. And contact tracing studies of COVID-19 and SARS, if you remember SARS, also a coronavirus 2003 pandemic, and others, flu, show that there's some forward and back movement of air. And the greatest risk is if someone sitting in your seat row is infected because of that side-to-side airflow. But there's also, the World Health Organization has said, two rows forward, two rows back, and all flight attendants are contacts. And some studies have found as many as seven rows away. Because when that service card is pushed through the aisle, it entrains air. The dry little particles travel up and down. People get out of their seat. They talk. The system isn't perfect. So, and there's some sort of messy reality of being a bunch of human beings in a small enclosed space that puts people at higher risk. So this idea that, you know, the aircraft is the safest place to be, it's just, well, I could think of all sorts of words, but it's untrue.
That was the voice of Judith Anderson, industrial hygienist with the Association of Flight Attendants, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I wish, but it's all in vain, but it's all in vain.
All in vain, Chumbawamba. Last week, the World Health Assembly elected Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus to another 5-year term as Director General of the World Health Organization. 17 EU countries and 11 other nations nominated Dr. Tedros, but only 3 African nations, Rwanda, Botswana, and Kenya, joined them. Candidates are typically nominated by their nation of origin, but Ethiopia did not nominate Dr. Tedros, a former health and foreign minister for the government, when it was dominated by the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, commonly known as the TPLF. COVID Race and Democracies and Garrison reports from Gondar, Ethiopia.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus became the World Health Organization's Director General in 2017, the year before his TPLF party was ousted from power in Ethiopia, and 3 years before it launched a war to regain power. Despite UN and WHO guidelines requiring UN officials to serve with political impartiality, he has, since the beginning of that war, used his global platform to portray the TPLF as victims and advocate for Western intervention on their behalf. Gitesha Rita, advisor to the president of Tigray, TPLF executive committee member, TPLF central command member, and head of Tigray's external affairs office, congratulated Tedros on Twitter, to which Tedros responded, quote, "Thank you, my brother," unquote. After Tedros was elected, with the votes of 155 of 194 WHO member nations, Ethiopia's representative to the UN in Geneva objected that Botswana's representative had illegitimately offered Tedros the support of the 54-member Africa group, even though the group had not reached consensus.
As I clearly stated, this is against the rules of procedure. Botswana has not the consensus. The distinguished representative of Botswana has not the consensus to speak on behalf of the African group. First, he needs to pass this as a decision within the group, which was not decided. So there is no consensus to deliver the statement and even speak on behalf of the group. There is no consensus, and I want this to be on record. There is no African region minus some states. There is one African region, and that, if my memory serves me right, includes my country, Ethiopia. If there is no consensus, even one single country opposes, there is no consensus to speak on behalf of the region. Botswana is welcome to list the countries and speak on behalf of A, B, C, if it so wishes, but not on behalf of the African region minus states. Let it be on record. I thank you.
Botswana eventually spoke on behalf of 45 African nations, indicating that 9 did not vote for Tedros. Minishle Mezereta Bibi, assistant professor of global journalism at the University of Gondar in the city of Gondar, Ethiopia, said that Tedros openly advocates for the TPLF.
He is practically engaged in the internal conflict in Ethiopia. And look at his Facebook page, look at his Twitter handle, and everything that he writes in the case of Ethiopia, in the case of Africa, is full of politics because he has a stake on this crisis in Ethiopia and he's putting a gas on the already fragile situation. And about your question in terms of asking for intervention, he is begging this big government to do something crazy on Ethiopia. And this is really shocking to see as an Ethiopian who is trying to destabilize his own country for the sake of his personal political gains, which he has as a member of TPLF and the Central Executive Committee of TPLF.
Professor Abebe also said that Tedros is unfit to serve as the world's top health official because, while serving as Ethiopia's Minister of Health, he covered up a cholera epidemic. And in his first term as WHO chief, he ignored the TPLF's willful destruction and looting of hospitals and health centers during its invasions of Ethiopia's Amhara and Afar regions.
When he was a minister of health in Ethiopia, he had been hiding a cholera outbreak from Ethiopia. And he said it's an Amharic atat, which is some kind of diarrhea, it's not cholera. And he has been constantly supporting TPLF, who has been destroying health centers, hospitals and everything. And he have never said a word about all of these distractions.
For the past 2 months, I have been traveling in Ethiopia, first in Amhara region with U.S. photojournalist Jamal Countess, then in Afar and Amhara regions with Scoop New Zealand journalist Alistair Thompson. We have seen, and they have photo-documented, the TPLF destruction and looting of hospitals and health centers that Dr. Tedros has ignored. In Gondar, Amhara region, Ethiopia, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.